This is an ABC podcast.
The measures to contain and suppress COVID-19 are getting stricter by the day. As of this morning, a new hard border is in place between Victoria and New South Wales, and the Victorian border with South Australia is closing this evening too. There are also millions heading into a tough new lockdown in Greater Melbourne from midnight, with renewed bans on being outside with more than one person, exercising beyond the city and suburbs, and dining in cafes and restaurants. All the restrictions coupled with the new hard border closures are dramatic, but they're not without precedent. In fact, exactly the same things were tried 100 years ago during the Spanish flu. I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre. And today on The Signal, we're revisiting the moment when containment failed in 1919, when a brand new virus jumped the border from Melbourne up to Sydney before moving on to other states and killing more than 15,000 people in a second wave. So why did our state containment measures fail back then? And will we avoid the same mistakes this time?
These are unsustainably high numbers of new cases. Cusp of a second wave, what people want to call this is entirely irrelevant. We have to be realistic about the circumstances that we confront. And that is why the public health team have advised me to reimpose stage 3 stay-at-home restrictions effective from midnight tomorrow night for a period of 6 weeks.
So a lot of people, especially but not only the Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews, are deeply afraid right now that COVID-19 has run away from us, and not just in Melbourne. And the shape that fairly understandable fear is taking is renewed lockdowns and closed borders. And it'll be weeks before we really know whether or not that's worked. But Australia has been here before, almost exactly here, actually. So to hear about it, we called medical historian Peter Hobbins from the University of Sydney.
I really want to piece together with you a timeline of what happened in the 1919 influenza pandemic. And we're going to get to that in a sec. But just to sort of lay the groundwork, can you give me a sense about the illness back in 1919 and what it was and how it compares to what we're dealing with today?
So in 1918, a new version of the well-established influenza disease appeared in Europe and the United States. Now, it seemed to be different from the typical influenza that went around pretty much every winter. This one was highly infectious, and as the year 1918 went on, it also became increasingly deadly. And what was really alarming about this new form of flu that came to be called Spanish influenza was that it targeted an unusual group. So influenza normally causes great risks for young kids, particularly those under about 18 months, and for older folks over 60 or 65. This new Spanish flu was actually most deadly and caused the most serious cases in people who aged about 20 to 40 years, and that was really unusual at the time. Now, for a lot of people who caught this version of the flu, it was just like getting normal flu. But if they had a more severe case, then they really moved into having severe trouble breathing and their lungs would fill up with the sort of watery fluid that ended up potentially drowning them in their own lung fluids, and certainly said that that was the reason that most of them died. So compared with COVID-19, there are certainly some striking similarities. I mean, with COVID, we don't see the same age profile. I think we're seeing a more typical influenza or respiratory disease profile where the elderly, particularly those over 80, are highly at risk. But what the two diseases do have in common is the profound attack on their system.
So let's talk about how the influenza pandemic of 1918-1919, I mean, how did it arrive in Australia? You said in that answer before that it was sort of in Europe and North America. How did it get here?
In 1918, the only way you could arrive in Australia was by ship. There were no aircraft flying into the country that year. And in fact, the very first aeroplane to ever land in Australia from overseas did so in December 1919, just after the pandemic ended. And so basically, every case that arrived in Australia had to come by ship, and there were a huge number of ships coming to Australia in late 1918 because because the First World War had just ended. So there were normal passenger ships and freighters, but there were also a huge number of troop transports bringing home soldiers from the First World War. All of these ships were intercepted at Australian quarantine stations, particularly at Woodman Point, just outside of Perth, at Melbourne's Point Nepean quarantine station, and also the quarantine station at North Head in Sydney. They certainly landed at other places like Darwin too, but those three really bore the brunt of a lot of the cases. So ships would come in and patients with the disease and anyone who'd been in any contact with them would be quarantined and treated. So in fact, for several months at the end of 1918, just as World War One came to an end, there were hundreds of people with Spanish flu sick and sometimes dying at Australian quarantine stations. But it didn't break out of quarantine. The disease remained within those quarantine stations and on board those ships.
Okay, so far it is all sounding weirdly similar to Australia's early experiences with COVID-19, a devastating pandemic threatening to claim millions of lives in the Northern Hemisphere, but thanks to a quick response and tough border controls, including quarantine protocols here, Australia was, for the most part, spared.
Yeah, but then some new cases cropped up in Melbourne, and the creepy parallels just keep coming.
Initially, there was just a small number. You know, initially there was a few in the Melbourne hospital, and certainly a range of experts were brought in to observe the cases. And one of the problems was that most of the doctors who were familiar with Spanish flu were still overseas. They were with the Australian Army Medical Corps, and they'd seen hundreds or thousands of cases, in fact, in Australian military personnel in Europe and in Britain. So people most familiar with the clinical presentation of the case were mostly overseas. But there were quite a few doctors, well, there were certainly a number of doctors who worked in Australian quarantine stations who'd seen plenty of cases at Point Nepean and at North Head in Sydney as well. So they knew what it looked like, at least in its more severe forms. So when these first cases started appearing in Melbourne of a very severe form of flu, they really weren't sure what they were looking at. And they basically said, look, it doesn't seem to have broken out in the community in the way we would expect if these people had been walking around before they came to hospital. But also the cases who were in hospital didn't seem to be suffering quite as severely as even the people just, you know, tens of kilometres away at the quarantine station. So they were pretty cautious about it, and they didn't want to cause panic. They didn't want to admit that this might be the pandemic, maybe it was in the community. They weren't necessarily hiding. It wasn't a conspiracy to keep things silent. They just wanted to be sure before they let that news out, because they knew what a dramatic social and economic impact it would have if we had to have much more severe restrictions on movement.
But then it didn't stay in Melbourne, did it? Can you tell us what happened next?
Yes, unfortunately, just before the Victorian health authorities realised that actually this was a more severe case, a soldier who we only know as SL caught a train from Melbourne to Sydney. So he'd come home from the war and was heading home to Sydney. He caught an overnight train from Melbourne to Sydney, and he noticed that he was sharing his compartment on the train with somebody who was pretty ill. They were coughing through the night and really didn't look very well. They were probably feverish and just looked pretty glassy-eyed and awful. As we all know what it's like when you're around somebody who's got a bad case of flu. So this soldier got to Sydney, and a couple of days later, which was, you know, the typical incubation period for Spanish flu, he presented to the Randwick Military Hospital. And at first, his case was misdiagnosed. It was thought he had some sort of diarrheal fever. But gradually, other doctors visiting the hospital diagnosed his case, realised that actually this was a genuine case of pneumonic influenza. Sadly, by then, it had already started spreading to the medical and nursing staff and to some of the visitors, and that's how it got out into the community in Sydney.
And pretty soon after that, the border between New South Wales and Victoria is slammed shut.
Word started flying almost straight away once it was diagnosed as a genuine case of Spanish flu in New South Wales, because it was very clear that this soldier had been in Melbourne just a few days earlier. So New South Wales started accusing Victoria of hiding these cases, or at least of not diagnosing them. So they very rapidly declared New South Wales infected. They really only had a handful of cases at that point. by this stage, there were already 350 cases in Victoria, who then said, yes, okay, we have it too. So despite having agreed between all the states and the Commonwealth government that the Commonwealth would make decisions about when states would be declared infected and when the borders would be closed, New South Wales unilaterally said, we are closing the border with Victoria henceforth. And they did. It came down almost immediately within hours practically. Now, Victoria didn't close their border with New South Wales, but pretty soon after that, the South Australian border with both Victoria and New South Wales was closed. And then Queensland also closed their border against New South Wales because it had declared itself an infected state. Not long after that, Western Australia also said, well, we don't want any cases coming across here by train, so we're going to close our borders against anybody coming from the east. And at the same time, Tasmania said, well, we're going to maintain a really rigorous maritime quarantine. We're going to basically quarantine any ship that's likely to be bringing food into the island.
And those state borders, when they were put up with New South Wales going first and then followed by South Australia, Victoria, Queensland and Western Australia, how did they enforce the border closure? I mean, was it chaotic? And this is the last time that it's happened, right? So, I mean, what mistakes did they make back then that we need to be aware of?
They did it very suddenly, and that was probably the major mistake. You know, there had been some discussion about how to do it, but there hadn't really been a lot of planning for how to implement it. When you bring down a border straight away and there are trains, for instance, heading towards the border, and suddenly you're a traveller, for instance, somebody from Wodonga who's crossed the border into Albury, what do you do? You're left there with the money in your pocket, the clothes on your back, and not much else. The state governments were saying, well, this isn't our responsibility. The Commonwealth government was saying, well, this is not our responsibility. In the meantime, here are people running out of money, nowhere to sleep, and they're basically having to fall on the charity of locals to put them up and provide them with meals. And it caused also people to break the rules sometimes. So these border crossings were patrolled by police, sometimes on foot or horse or camel. But local residents trying to get home, particularly those who live near the border, would sometimes skirt the regulations. They'd swim across the Murray River, or they'd get a boat across, or they'd find a bridge that wasn't patrolled by the police, or a gas line or a sewer line that went across the river or across the border where they could sneak home and try to find their way back.
Okay, so it was a bit of a mess. And the New South Wales Police Commissioner, Mick Fuller, has apparently read that particular page in history.
Some 650 police are currently travelling down to the border to commence the operation. The Australian Defence Force has agreed to assist. There'll be some 100 members of defence on the ground from Thursday, and that will grow to 350 over the weekend.
Still, even if they had managed to stop every single person sneaking through in 1919, there was the question of timing, because case numbers were already climbing on both sides of the border by the time they officially shut it off. So you have to wonder whether it really helped all that much.
Well, it didn't stop the spread in New South Wales, so on that count, it didn't help. It failed. Peter does say, in a funny way, some of the other closures did some good.
Between October 1918, when the very first cases started appearing in quarantine, and January 1919, when it broke out of quarantine, the virus itself had mutated a bit. It actually was milder. It was still very infectious, very easy to catch, but people weren't having nearly as many severe cases, and certainly the death rate was much lower in Australia than elsewhere.
Right.
Now, that what's called attenuation of the virus continued, so that in fact states that managed to maintain their own border quarantines, particularly Western Australia and Tasmania, found that when the virus did end up entering their state, it was a much milder version and they had a much less severe time of it. In fact, Tasmania had hardly any deaths at all.
And And in the end, how badly affected was Australia by this influenza pandemic? And was the fact that, as you say, we got a milder version when the outbreaks really started to grow here, I mean, was that critical in, you know, meaning that we weren't as badly affected as some other parts of the world?
Yes, is the short answer. Look, Australia had about the same infection rate as most other parts of the world, roughly. We think particularly in the eastern or southeastern states, it was about a third or a quarter of the whole population caught the flu.
Wow.
But the big difference was our death rate was one of the lowest anywhere in the world. So, for instance, the flu got into New Zealand in October 1918, a similar sort of demographic, you know, makeup of the population in terms of their health and their racial profiles and their nutrition and so on. They had it in October 1918 onwards. We had it from January 1919 onwards, just 3 months. Their death rate was at least twice as high as ours.
What for you are the lessons from this experience, and do you think that we've learnt them?
It's always hard to learn lessons from the past because the world was so different then. Yeah. You know, for instance, there were very few telephones. There was no wireless. There was no television. There was certainly no internet. Having said that, though, I think one of the most important things that we have in common with 1919 is the behaviour of individuals. You know, do we choose to stay at home? Do we choose to cancel a holiday, make sure we stay at home when we think we're sick? Those were the measures that worked in 1919, and they also seemingly have been working pretty well in Australia in 2020 as well. We've certainly seen cases from overseas where those official restrictions and personal choices didn't have the same effect that they did here. So I think in many ways, you know, we have chosen as a society to care about each other, to try to follow the rules, to try to find out the best advice, and to try to look out for each other. And I think, you know, it's been a shame, obviously, to see that we're now seeing a second wave potentially starting to emerge. In 1919, that's exactly what happened. So there were severe restrictions in the early phases. The restrictions started to be relaxed when it looked like the disease was under control. Unfortunately, there was a second wave, and it was twice as severe and led to twice as many deaths as the first wave. So I think that is a lesson we need to keep in mind this year. Not to say it will happen this year, but there's always that risk that just if you think you can relax and you let things go a little too long, a viral disease that's highly infectious and very deadly can easily get out of control, even though you thought you'd had it conquered just a few weeks earlier.
That's today's episode. If you are enjoying The Signal, please take the time to write us a review on Apple Podcasts. We do like to hear from you, but also it helps new people who aren't you to find us.
And if you want to drop us a line, our email is thesignal@abc.net.au. And we'll be back right here with a new episode tomorrow.
We'll catch you then.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.